Welcome to Free for All Fridays on the iHeartRadio Talk Network. Here's your host, Amanda Galbraith.
Hello. Welcome to the show. It's Friday. It is beautiful where I'm sitting here in Ontario. I hope it's beautiful where you are. This is Free for All Friday, where we bring the top talent from across the iHeartRadio Talk Network to debate the five biggest stories of the week. And today we have with me Ken Eastwood, morning show host on News Talk 1290 in London, Ontario, and Ryan Price, news director and afternoon drive host on CFAX 1070 in Victoria, BC. Ken, Ryan, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, guys. Yeah,
great to see you. How's it going?
Or hear you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Perfect. And always, listeners, free to text the show at 71010. You know, we get takes from the panel, but I'd love to hear from you. So the first story, I was all looking forward to hot girl summer, but Prime Minister Trudeau told us this week, not so fast.
The one dose summer sets us up for a two dose fall.
So what is a one dose summer? I mean, what does that even mean? So Prime Minister Trudeau said it will be a slightly better summer, quote unquote. But is this good enough for you? And is this good enough for a panel? We'll find out. Premier Doug Ford of Ontario says no.
June the 2nd, we'll have further information for the people. But our goal is to have as normal July and August as possible. And I'm confident we can do it. We've come a long way throughout this pandemic. Everyone's worked extremely hard. And I'm very confident we're going to have a good July and August. And again, I don't believe in a one-dose summer. I believe that we're going to have a two-dose summer.
Now, he's not alone. Manitoba's also come out and said they're, quote, determined to have a two-dose summer and expect to get there by mid to end July. So far, for those keeping track, 40% of Canadians have received their first dose, while only 3% have been fully vaccinated. Now today, Health Canada came out with guidelines that got me a little excited that says if we reach 75% with one dose and 20% with two, we could see the return of small outdoor gatherings with family and friends, camping, hiking, picnics, patios, people. The current target is every eligible Canadian can have their first shot by this summer and fully vaccinated by September. So question to the panel, Ken, are you okay with a one dose summer?
Honestly, up until the Health Canada clarification, I didn't know what the heck a one dose. Honestly, I thought Trudeau was like taking up square dancing calling or something. It's a one dose summer and a two dose fall. I didn't know what that. It literally meant nothing because he has said before that that vaccine alone was not going to save us, that we would need to continue the public health measures. We would still have to do, you know, the physical distancing, the masking, you know, all of the things we've been asked to do. So what changes with, and still, I don't think we necessarily know what changes. I mean, okay, what happens if we don't hit that 75% benchmark? Then a one-dose summer means literally nothing at all.
Yeah, I will say I am, maybe it's just the word patio in there that got me a little bit more enthusiastic. But, you know, that we do have to get 20% with a second vaccination, right? I mean, I know we're moving incredibly quickly. Like, we just got news this week that Canada is actually starting to vaccinate on per capita basis faster now than the U.S., but we're still a long ways off. Ryan, are you okay with a one-dose summer, or are you with the premier and say no?
Well, I have to agree with the panel here that I had no idea what one-dose and two-dose summers were supposed to be, and now I'm hearing prime ministers and premiers arguing about, no, I'm going to have a two-dose summer. And like, those terms were completely foreign to me. But anyways, I thought it was strange to hear Ontario's premier, Doug Ford, saying, no, we're determined to have a two-dose summer. It seems like that's a bit hard to say. There's so many things to determine. How does the vaccination rollout go? Will there be any more hiccups along the way? Will we get the amounts we're expecting? Will variants cause trouble? There's so many questions. And here in BC, this came up yesterday. We had our provincial health officer, who tends to be more the voice of the pandemic response in this province, less so the premier, was asked a bunch of questions yesterday along the same lines. What does our summer look like? Our vaccination rates are are getting so high. This week, we in BC got over 50% of the population with their first dose. By this weekend, in BC, by this weekend, all age groups 18 plus will be able to book their vaccination appointment. Now, they're still working on the kids, the 12 to 18, but we are looking at a place where we will get those first doses at least pretty soon. So it does lead to the question, what does that mean? In BC, we currently have our stricter restrictions that got brought into place a couple of months ago. They are due to be revisited as of the Victoria Day long weekend. And so everybody was asking, does this mean we can start to ease up? And here's what we heard for BC with the same caveats that we can't really predict what's the summer is going to be because there's so many variables, but we're not expecting anything to change after Victoria Day. The goal is by Canada Day long weekend in BC, maybe we start to expand to small gatherings. Maybe what we used to have back at the beginning of this pandemic where you had those small groups that were okay as long as they were, you know, you weren't seeing everybody and making too many social contacts, you know, keep to the same groups. But that could be what we get to, which I think was a very muted and cautious response to try to keep expectations low. If we all behave and things go well by the Canada Day long weekend, maybe you're having some small groups. And obviously outdoor stuff has always been encouraged. But I think that messaging was meant more to be don't get the hopes up. Don't get people too excited about whatever a two-dose summer is. I still don't even know what that's supposed to mean. Because you never know. This thing has had so many curveballs thrown around. I think that's probably the better response.
Yeah, and I think, you know, where I pick up there, and I think you're bang on, is it's expectations, right? I think the Prime Minister and the federal government have done a pretty good job thus far of, you know, setting expectations with Canadians by saying, you know, one-dose summer, which I still think is ridiculous, but it's obviously a focus group tested marketing thing that they've
sounds like it.
Yeah, big time.
Well, all the ministers fanned out, right? And they all started saying one dose summer, and I immediately like thought of like hot girl summer, and I started kind of laughing at it. So I think it takes the sting out of it a little bit. But it also kind of feels like are we being treated like idiots a little bit? Like, is this the version of the new Coke? Remember Crystal Pepsi? Is this what the government's trying to do to us?
I mean, what do you
think, Ken?
Don't bring Crystal Pepsi back. That was a genius idea. I still lament the loss of Crystal Pepsi. That was a brilliant thing. I wish they could bring that back. But you're absolutely right. This is entirely marketing. I mean, just think of the timing. So at the same time, you've got U.S. President Joe Biden saying, look, Americans, if you're fully vaccinated, you can take the mask off. We can start to get back to normal. You've got, you know, good things happening. As Ryan said in BC, you know, they're giving them, you know, the carrot of Canada Day on the end of that stick saying, look, things are coming. We're moving along. Meanwhile, the same week here in Ontario, we have our stay-at-home order extended by 2 more weeks. We hear from the X and all these amazing, huge events in Toronto saying, look, we're not going to be able to – our summer's gone. There's no – I don't care, one-dose summer, two-dose summer. It's a no-go summer. Here in London, our festival season, we've already had a couple of our major festivals here in London say we're going virtual again this year. The Prime Minister has got to be seeing all this stuff going on and going, okay, we've got to give them some hope, some optimism. How about an empty platitude? And somebody came up with, well, why don't we use like one dose summer? That sounds good and it doesn't mean anything. Yeah, that's it. Let's go with that.
No, I think you're bang on there. Like, honestly, but I think we do need a little more hope. And that is one thing I feel like, particularly here in Ontario, is missing. I think we see in BC, you know, as Ryan was talking about, outdoor is encouraged, right? That's not something we're seeing here in Ontario. In fact, you know, they're sticking tents over top of basketball. You know, people are being fined for playing volleyball. Like, it's really, I think, over the top here. Even in Quebec, there's an understanding of outdoor participation. And here I feel like we have no hope in some areas of the province. So to me, it feels like empty platitudes, at least when I see these guidelines that have just come out from Health Canada that say, you know, if we hit this mark, camping, hiking, picnics, patios, small outdoor gatherings, those things can happen. And once, you know, for example, the fall, in theory, 75% of those eligible, if we get full vaccinations, we can have college back, indoor sports, family gatherings. I mean, like, I feel like something's on the way. I'm not sure if I would have picked one dose summer as my tagline, but, you know, this federal government's really good at marketing. So, you know, good on them for, I think, at least figuring out and doing something that will that will work for the rest of the Canadian population. But, you know, we should note, by the way, listeners, by the end of June, Canada will have 50 million doses and there'll be 100 million in our hands by the end of September. So that's lots of shots coming our way. So could we be heading towards another referendum in Quebec? Find out next on Free For All Friday. I'm Amanda Galbraith on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
This is Free For All Fridays with host Amanda Galbraith on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Hello, welcome back to the show where we tackle the five biggest stories of the week. I'm joined today by Ken Eastwood, morning show host on News Talk 1290 in London, Ontario, and Ryan Price, news director and afternoon drive host on CFAX 1070 in Victoria, BC. You can also feel free to text the show at 71010 if you have a thought. I'll read it out loud if I can get to it. So Quebec this week, next big story, announced significant reforms to language laws yesterday with the goal of, quote, strengthening the use of French in the province. These are sweeping implications for businesses, if you're an immigrant, if you're a student, even if you're a member of the public. Some of the things that are in this bill, which is 100 pages, there's going to be a new French language commissioner that will be tasked with, quote, like with monitoring the knowledge, learning, and use of French language by immigrants. Bilingual municipalities, so basically if there's less than half their residents speak English, will lose their status as bilingual. Access to CGEP, so which that's sort of the place between high school and college. It's sort of a program they have there in Quebec. The English acceptance will be frozen at a certain threshold, so it can't go up anymore. You can't say I want to be educated in English versus French any more than the current level is. Students will all now have to pass a French language test. And there's also a snitch line to call if you're not served in French. So what happens if you get the famous bonjour hi when you walk into a Quebec store or restaurant? Here's Quebec Justice Minister Simon Jolin-Barrette on that.
When you're welcome with a bonjour, it's not covered by the bill. What we are tabled today, it's that about the fundamental rights to be served or to be informed in French. You know, it was already in the bill, but it was not enforceable. So right now, with the bill, it will be.
He also said he does not want to start a language war with this bill.
I don't want to oppose one language to another. It's not about a battle between French and English.
So if we put aside, we're not even through this yet. So put aside the snitch lines, the monitoring of immigrants who may or may not be speaking French. There's also huge constitutional implications that will require an amendment to, quote, recognize Quebec as a separate nation and French as its only official language. I mean, we know politically this puts PM Trudeau in a tough spot, and it also puts him directly opposed to Premier Legault, who's riding incredibly high on the polls if he were to stand up against any of this. So this is political analyst and former Quebec politician Tom Mulcair dissecting that part of the bill.
He was there to talk about the big play. And the big play is to change the status of Quebec within Canada and the status of French that Quebec wants to protect, saying that Quebec will be recognized as a separate nation and it has the right to declare French its only official language. They want that in the Constitution.
So, I mean, there is so much to chew on here, but I think my first question is, you know, do you think... is this the first step towards another referendum? Because basically, anyone opposes this, they can say, fine, you don't recognize us. We want to separate as Quebec. Ryan, was that you I heard laughing or was it Ken?
That was me. That was Ken.
All right. What do you think?
Well, do I think that this will lead us to another referendum? No, I don't. Why bother? Why bother with a referendum when you found a fantastic loophole that means separation without separation? I mean, when you can hide separation under the guise of a language bill, because that's exactly, make no mistake, Thomas Mulcair was absolutely right. That's what this is. This is separation by piecemeal. You take the things that you, that mean you are separate, and you tackle them individually. And this is the big one. In fact, they've written it right into the bill that it makes them a unique nation. And as far as I think what I snickered at was how much they care about English Quebecers. bull. No chance. You know, Premier Francois Legault has said himself, quote, it's nothing against English Quebecers. It's all about protecting French. Well, you cannot have it both ways. This is a blow against English Quebecers. I've had family who have lived in Quebec since, even before I was born. And I think one or two remain. And they leave because of language. It is, even then, 20, 30 years ago, it was a difficult place for, and I'm talking about, you know, rural Montreal, in and around the Montreal area, in predominantly English-speaking neighborhoods. It's a difficult place to be an Anglophone, and if this bill is passed, it will be almost impossible.
Yeah, I think, and that's one of the things, we're actually talking to one of our colleagues at CJAD, I was talking to them last week, saying that, you know, this is going to be a tough pill to swallow for a lot of English Quebecers. I mean, in particular, the thing that really kind of freaks me out is this Orwellian snitch line they're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, Ryan, what do you think of that?
Well, yeah, there's. I'm going to preface this by saying I live as far from Quebec as anybody else in the country because we're here on the far west coast. So, my opinions, take them with that grain of salt. But I feel like, yes, fine, protect the French language. You are a distinct nation within Canada, and French is the primary language you want to protect from dwindling. But the things that bother me here are things like you mentioned the snitch line, like those quotas on that education system. Only we're capping the amount of English only programs or you know, English students that we're going to cater to. I feel like those kind of moves are what rubs me the wrong way and might seem discriminatory towards those people that Ken just mentioned decide to move because there's a systemic system that doesn't let them thrive, doesn't let them do school, doesn't let them live without people snitching on them, businesses trying to operate. I feel like those are the moves that I am troubled by, but again, I'm pretty far removed from this. Protect the language, fine. Consider yourself a distinct nation within Canada. It was Stephen Harper who first brought that up a few years ago, so I don't have any problems with those, but there's a few issues in there that I think are maybe purposefully provocative to try to get us into this fight.
Yeah, and I remember I was actually working in the Harper government at the time in 2006 when he stood up in the. It was within his first year as prime minister. He stood up and said Quebec as a distinct nation within Canada. It caused a bit of a fuss with, you know, constitutional stalwarts. But at the end of the day, I don't take issue with that. I think Quebec is quite distinct. I've said that frequently. I think they have every right to say that. You know, as far as saying we can have a constitutional amendment, no, the rest of you don't need to weigh in on that. I mean, that's a whole other kettle of fish.
That's
something for the PM to deal with. Exactly. It's like, oh, yeah, we say we don't need to worry. I'm like, okay, fine. But, I mean, to me, it's where, for example, like the CJEP issue, right? That is a really great education system they have in Quebec. You know, for the last 25 years, the French enrollment has been declining. English has been rising. I mean, the fact that someone's going to be overseeing and monitoring the knowledge, learning, and use of French by immigrants, I mean, that to me, especially on the heels of the other bills they've passed this year, is, you know, I just find that incredibly concerning. Ken, what do you think about that?
Yeah, and that's a great point too, because, you know, put yourself in the shoes of a CJEP student or a potential CJEP student who's, you know, faced with the prospect of, you know, having that the French exit exam, right? So I guess your options are, well, I guess I better quickly become very literate in the French language. Or I decide to take my education elsewhere. And I think, you know, forcing the French language on people, I don't think is going to be the way to save what we know is a language in decline.
Yeah, and I think it's important for them to do the things they need to do to, like, they should be protecting their language, right? And in fact, this is basically a kind of a stepping up of what's called Bill 101, which was the Charter of French Language introduced by Levesque, who's a former premier in 1977. And in that bill, he actually required children of immigrants to attend French schools, right? Which was very, very controversial at the time. And now what they're seeing in their talk, in the premier is talking about, was that fewer than 50% of new immigrants speak French in Quebec. But I don't know. Kind of this anti-immigrant or the forcing of immigrants to speak French, I do think it's unwelcoming. I'm getting tons of texts right now who actually say people, I used to, example, someone in London, Ontario, I used to live in Montreal, I've now relocated to London, Ontario. So your stomping grounds there, Ken, because we felt like it wasn't welcoming, because we couldn't go there. I myself lived in Ottawa. I loved to go to Montreal. I talked about moving there for a little bit, but I felt like at the end of the day, as a primarily English speaking, although je parle en français, like I do speak a bit of French, it wouldn't have worked out for me professionally. So I think to a certain extent, they're cutting out some of the rest of Canada, but if that's what they feel to do to keep their language, I mean, we'll see how this shakes out. I think the bottom line is the prime minister is going to probably cave on this, so we won't see a referendum, but it'll be interesting to watch. So coming up, another COVID shutdown has just made it that much harder for Canadians to get around. Should the government step in to fix it? Find out next on Free For All Friday. I'm Amanda Galbraith on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
The Free For All Friday Roundtable continues on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Amanda Galbraith here, host of Free For All Friday. We recap the five biggest stories of the week, and I'm joined by the top talent from across the iHeartRadio Network. Today I have with me Ken Eastwood, morning show host on News Talk 1290 in London, Ontario, and Ryan Price, news director and afternoon drive host on CFAX 1070 in Victoria, BC. Now, we talked about this story before the show. We were kind of going back and forth, but I think it's really important and why we have it on the panel this week. Greyhound Canada announced yesterday it's permanently shutting down all bus routes across the country after nearly a century of operation. That's right. Greyhound has actually been operating in Canada for 100 years. That's a very long time, and I think a very significant contribution to how we get around this country. Now, this comes after they temporarily halted service in May because of the pandemic. Now, I, as a young person in university, I used Greyhound buses to get back and forth from home. My grandma, who was lived in London, Ontario, so shout out to you guys there. She used to ship me frozen soups to Ottawa on a Greyhound bus in a box, and that's how I would eat snacks. And those were my care packages. So, like, Greyhound really to me was important. But I will say, I have not used a Greyhound in a while, and it turns out I am not alone, according to BNN Bloomberg Western Bureau Chief Tara Weber.
Greyhound has been struggling for a number of years. Fewer of us take the bus. You know, there's a lot of other options out there, especially in the big cities when we look at the rideshare programs. On top of that, they are saying that they're competing with some of the other subsidized transportation services. That would be, you know, railways and other trains and buses that are in these cities as well. And then they say they're also facing deregulation. So, you know, they say they have done what they could over the last few years, putting fewer trips on their schedule, other cost efficiencies, but clearly it's not enough, and now it's coming to an end.
What people don't realize, though, is it is still a key source of transportation in many rural areas of Canada, particularly for Indigenous communities, folks that don't own a car. They had actually gone to the federal government to ask for money, but were told no. Yesterday, Public Safety Minister Bill Blair then opened the door after hearing they were closing to working with Greyhound to keep the service running.
Those bus services are essential, and I know within my own family and friends in my own community that I represent and serve, the Greyhound bus service has been absolutely a critical part of interprovincial travel. I know that the pandemic has had a very significant impact on them, and we are quite open to working with either Greyhound or any other provincial bus services in order to sustain that mode of transport, which we know is important to Canadians.
Now, for context, before I ask the question, we gave Air Canada, who's also an essential, the airlines are essential to get around, $5.9 billion in a bailout. But we have not yet to give anything to things like Greyhound, other than sort of the regular subsidies. So we bailed out the airlines. Should we bail out Greyhound? Ken, what do you think?
Unpopular opinion, no. I don't think we should. I really don't. I mean, you know, the first clue should be for a lot of people, when yourself included, Amanda, when we start talking about Greyhound, we start talking about nostalgia, all the great stories from our past, right? Well, nostalgia is never a great reason to keep doing something. And we know the big difference between Greyhound and Air Canada is when things get back to normal, Air Canada can be back in the black. Greyhound was a failing business model that was not doing well before COVID-19 hit. COVID-19 was that nail in the coffin. So should the government bail it out? No, absolutely not. Because if they did, they would be consistently bailing that company, that business, that industry even out for the foreseeable future. Now, what I will say is there are areas where the routes make sense. Here in London, we're seeing a lot of inter-community busing growth here. Some private businesses, some are actually operated by the smaller municipalities themselves, operating those local routes. But the key here is if there's demand. And if there isn't demand, then that need will not be and should not be filled.
But yeah, and I guess the question to me, for me though, is that I think places like, in theory, London would have some money to like subsidize a route between themselves and wherever else. But what about some of these indigenous communities, rural areas where they don't have the money to subsidize bus? I mean, we subsidize Via Rail. Like that is not, should be a moneymaker, but it is not a moneymaker. I don't know why we're not looking at, to me, I actually think busing is an essential service for Canadians, and they should look at it, and it's neglectful that they haven't. Ryan, where do you stand on this?
The Greyhound issue hasn't struck here as much because Greyhound actually already pulled out of BC a few years ago. So we're a little bit accelerated, but that means I have a bit of a crystal ball to tell you how this all played out here. So Greyhound already ditched out of BC at least 2 or 3 years ago. But in its place, other charter bus companies have been operating, have been finding the economical routes to operate, and is still helping out some of those remote routes. Here on Vancouver Island, we have a charter bus company that operates. It connects Victoria across the ferry to Vancouver, but also to some of the more remote areas on Vancouver Island. A lot of them northern parts of the island with a lot of indigenous communities. So they are important. They are functioning, but COVID has also been hurting those routes because they've had to shut down. They can't operate, or the travel is more limited. The BC government, recognizing the importance of this, did provide additional subsidies a month or two ago to allow those charter bus companies to survive because they were in the same boat that Greyhound is in today. A few months ago, the local companies that had picked up that torch from Greyhound a few years ago were about to cry uncle, saying, look, we can't make this go. We can't make it on just the subsidies that are the basic general ones, the ones that Greyhound was complaining about. So the BC government did cave, did provide some money to keep them going. Like you said, travel's a bit different. I mean, we've got low-cost airlines, we've got ride-sharing, vehicle ownership's a bit different. It's not the same playing field it was many years ago for the likes of Greyhound, but I think there still is an important place for these buses. I know here on Vancouver Island, it's still an important connection, not just for smaller indigenous communities, but a lot of our, you know, younger people who travel up to Tofino to go out to the beach communities. Buses are an important link there if you're younger and don't have the ability to drive out there. And it's or the ski buses are another thing we take a lot here. The coach buses have money-making routes that can offset things that still are valuable. And if we lost all those, I mean, those would be noticed. So I think the government was right to put some money into this, the BC government. It'll be interesting to see if the federal government follows the same pattern.
We're just getting texts, and by the way, the Hound was the best for shipping Christmas gifts out west, which I remember we used to ship Christmas gifts on Greyhound. But I actually have a question for you. So Ryan, you guys have already kind of had this experience of them leaving the west, and you've had private businesses come in to sort of subsidize than the government. Is it more expensive? Is it used just as much? Like, how is it? It's, you think it's gone well?
I think it's gone okay. I mean, like, I think ridership is a little lower. People don't use them quite like they used to, but they still seem to be able to make a go of it. I know the local transportation charter bus company is making it work. It's still a viable service. I don't think it's horrifically expensive. So like they've been able to pull it off and keep the rates reasonable. I'll have to be honest, I haven't taken one for a while. I have taken them before in my younger days. But it's the same boat, right? Like I feel like there are demographics that still need these, and I think the service has had to change. And with, you know, the Greyhounds of the world leaving and local companies really taking that place, they've had to adapt to that. Find the routes that work for money reasons, and they don't service the ones as much. And it's those ones that I think the government needs to take action on. If you think that some northern community that is very far removed from places and maybe is impoverished needs that bus connection still, I think it is in the government's best interest to cough up that money right now and keep those routes going.
Now, Ken, 30 seconds to you real quick. London is a big university town, and I remember frequently riding the Greyhound home. Do you think this is going to be a big hole for students there?
I really don't. So my quick experience, last experience was Greyhound. I was sending my daughter to school in Toronto from London, looked at Greyhound, looked at Via. They were the same price. So we decided, obviously we're going to go with Via. So it used to be that low cost option. I'm not even sure that it is anymore because of that declining demand. They have to match it with increased prices.
Yeah, and last time I was on a Greyhound, if we're going down memory lane, I actually missed a flight home because I may have been out partying the night before as a student for Thanksgiving. I was in Ottawa. So my parents stuck me on a Greyhound for a 16-hour milk run across the province as punishment, which I richly deserved. But I did make it home safe. So Greyhound to the rescue at that point. And then I think after that experience, to be honest, I didn't jump back on. So fond memories of Greyhound. And we'll interesting to see how this evolves and if there's a model that's sort of like what happened out in BC. So I love, speaking of partying, I love a good bar as much as the next bar, especially if it has a theme. So why is Victoria City Council all worked up about a new tiki bar? Find out next on Free For All Friday. I'm Amanda Galbraith on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
You're listening to Free For All Fridays with host Amanda Galbraith on the iHeartRadio Talk Network.
Welcome back to the show, and that is some intense music that we have played for you, some headbanging rock. I'm Amanda Galbraith here, host of Free For All Friday, where we recap the five biggest stories of the week, and this is the back half of the show where we do the last two and hopefully have a bit of a laugh. First, with me today, I've got Ken Eastwood, who's the morning show host on News Talk 1290 in London, Ontario, and Ryan Price, news director and afternoon drive host on CFAX 1070 in Victoria, BC. And Ryan, we've got another BC story for you here. So British Columbia just announced it will now prevent people from renewing their driver's licenses if they haven't paid their COVID fines. So to all you scofflaws out there, a term I learned when I did not pay my parking tickets once. If you have an unpaid COVID fine, you might be denied. The change is set to come into effect on July 1st. Here's what BC Public Safety Minister Mike Farnsworth said about this.
It's not a measure to deny people their licenses. It is a debt collection tool. It's time people take their tickets seriously.
Now, for those who are listening, in BC, the fine is about $575 for non-compliance. Hosting a prohibited event is over $2,000. In Ontario, fail to comply is $750, but it can go up to $100,000 if you host parties and you're in jail. In Quebec, it's about $1,000 if you break the rules and up to $6,000 if you break curfew. So curious, Ryan, how did this go over in BC? And do you think we should do this across the province, across the country?
I'm personally in favor because there, a lot of the tickets, at least we talk about here, are going to things that seem to be flagrant disrespect of the rules. Say, you know, hosting a giant party, which is a clear violation. I don't think a lot of these tickets are going to things that would be fairly innocent. Like, oh, you had your grandmother over and you're getting a ticket. That doesn't seem to be where these things are going. It seems to be actual big problem. So to have all these fines is one thing. A lot of them haven't been paid is something we had been talking about and learning a bit more over the last few months. So the government's trying to put some teeth in there because they were getting that question from reporters like, hey, are people actually paying these fines? Are you collecting on them? And it's not like we're trying to raise money off of this. It's more, I think, the people who are following the rules and are really uncomfortable with the case load that we've had over the past few months, and this third wave has just been a doozy. I think a lot of people just want to see those who are disrespecting the rules punished and to actually cough up the money. So here's the government's way of, I think, in a fairly gentle way, tying it to the license renewal, making those people pay. You can still get your license. You just got to pay the fine that you should be paying anyway. So I think I'm okay with that. I think most people are okay with that. I don't think there's been a huge backlash. There is a little backlash from folks like the BC Civil Liberties Association, who are against too much enforcement. I mean, public health advice is one thing, but for them, there's always the concern that could, once you get police involved in tickets, could this start to affect marginalized communities more or racialized communities? Could this start to be a thing where that's happening? They've been bringing up those questions. As far as I can tell, at least in my backyard here, the tickets that are going out are just for idiots that are holding giant parties. They're not for anybody who's getting discriminated against, at least as far as I can see. But I don't want to discount that could be a thing we need to be aware of. But yeah, I like it. I don't think it's caused a huge backlash. And if this plan got adopted across the country, I think it would just be a gentle way to make sure those fines get paid.
See, where I worry is I think in early days of this pandemic, we saw stuff. Like, I remember a guy in Toronto got a fine for working out in public, you know, like in a park, right? And we've now learned that that is ridiculous. So those people, I don't think, if you've had a giant party, that's one thing to me. But if you've done stuff like that, I really do think those should be challenged. Ken, do you think we should adopt this across the country?
I don't think it matters, honestly. I don't think it's going to, I mean, you're right. I think it may affect some of those, you know, like Ryan pointed out, you know, the parties, you know, but there really are two types of, to use your word, scofflaws. There are those, the ones who, you know, held the party and need to pay up. But then there's also this morning, we got a court decision against the church in Aylmer that has got a lot of attention paid to it in and around London. The church fined $35,000, the pastor with a $10,000 fine. He's not paying that. He's going to challenge it in court. It's going to take months, if not years, to finally get a decision in that. And by the end of it, you know, will him not being able to renew his license be the catalyst for him paying a $10,000 or a $35,000 fine? No. So, I could give or take this one.
All right. And here's our last topic. We got a couple minutes left. A tiki bar is being opened in Victoria. I love tiki bars. I think they're lots of fun, and I've enjoyed myself at them. So it's an ode to the 50s-style American bars, you know, when GIs were returning from the South Pacific. Now, a local councillor there is expressing concerns that it is cultural appropriation. Here's a clip from last night's CTV Vancouver newscast from Jordan Cunningham talking about the city councillor who opposed the idea.
The application for their liquor license went in front of City Council at last Thursday's Committee of the Whole. Most seemed on board. Concern came from Councillor Ben Isett.
From the standpoint of cultural appropriation of the culture of Pacific Islanders.
Now, Ken, is this concern ridiculous? Like, are we taking this too far, or is it good to ask the question?
I guess there's no harm in asking the question. I still think the answer is no. It's a valid question, but honestly, I'm completely ignorant. I had no idea that tiki could even have been considered cultural appropriation. We had just up the Huron coast here north of London in Goderich, they had planned, they've got a nice, beautiful new boardwalk. They were all set to launch a series of businesses along that boardwalk. COVID-19 unfortunately shut those businesses down. One of them was a beachside tiki hut. And I can't tell, I was almost as excited as Amanda Galbraith.
I am known, so there's one area in Toronto called Shameful Tiki, where you get this like huge bowl and there's fire in the middle, and thinking about it in COVID, you have straws and everybody drinks out of it. Like, I can't even imagine a world that we do that like now. But I love tiki bars. I actually had one in my backyard. My dad had one growing up. Ken, where do you stand on this one?
You mean Ryan?
Ryan, sorry, Ryan, where do you stand on this one?
Oh, sure. I mean, I liked Ken's opinion, so he could just say it twice. No, but I feel like this, these issues are really hard for me, these, because I'm a white guy, and my gut might be to say, oh, there's no problem here. We're not trying to be offensive at all. But I guess I'm glad the discussion is coming up, because maybe there are some problems here that I'm just blind to because of where I sit in the world. I would hope that this isn't going to necessarily be the exact tiki bar of old. I mean, maybe there were some colonial undertones. Well, there certainly were some colonial undertones to those ones, you can imagine. Although they weren't trying to be exactly some Polynesian exact cultural thing that we were taking on. They were this weird hodgepodge of Americans blending all sorts of stuff together. So as long as it's done appropriately, I think you can do it sensitively. You don't have to be drinking out of Maori heads and really doing up the Polynesian culture too much. It could just be about great cocktails that are kind of summery and fruity, and, you know, maybe there's some umbrellas. I think you can do it right as long as you don't, as long as you're having this discussion. So I guess I'm glad it's coming up.
All right. Well, Ryan, Ken, thank you so much for coming on the show and for the great discussion. Hope to have you back again.
Yeah, great to chat with you both.
Anytime.
Awesome. Yeah, hopefully maybe we can even do it at a pub or a patio or something if forevermore we get that one-dose summer going through. So thanks for the chat,
Johnny. Two-dose summer in a tiki bar.
Woo! Yeah!
Sign me right up. Donnie, Sam, and Nick, thank you so much. I'm your host, Amanda Galbraith. I will see you next Friday.